Hello and welcome to Holden Village. Today is Tuesday, July the 27th, 1999, and in Quinania Fireside Room this evening, we will hear this session by Ann Peterson, Dissonance Standing on the Boundaries, number 99-6. Let's listen in.
I have almost five after. Is that right? We start it right.
Oh, you're a little fast. It's about 1 minute after.
A minute after, okay. Yeah. We will go ahead and begin. I am Ann Peterson, and we've been up at Holden now about 10, 11 days. So we took the boat to Stehekin today and got a little of the world I couldn't resist, a cheeseburger. So just couldn't take it any longer, and also called our best friends in Sioux Falls, who had been, we have dog sitters for the whole summer, two wonderful students who moved into our house, who have a third dog, another dog, so we have three dogs in this little tiny house of ours, and they were gone for 4 days to Chicago, so our other friends took their two dogs and our two dogs. So I called Janet today and I said, is your house still in one piece? Knowing that our dog, who is known for eating large quantities of furniture, last November chewed up our entire couch one day, I wanted to make sure that the house has not been destroyed. So we got an affirmation that life was in good shape.
Just saying, we're sorry.
Wilfred had so much playtime with his girlfriend Jessie that things were in good shape. So. I teach theology at Augustana College in Sioux Falls, South Dakota. And there's some other former Sioux Fallites here. We were coming down on the bus today and somebody said something about the Rodies. And sure enough, Paul and Susan Rody are here. They were parts of our lives for a long time now. So we are thrilled to know that they're up here. And I think I'm working on ways to get their three daughters, Inga, Anna, and Sarah, into my sessions each day. We didn't know how to do that today because we just ran into them. So I've already asked Paul to do something. But yeah, we're going to see if we can get a little bit of music at the beginning of each session. So if you don't like theology, you can at least come to hear some music. The sessions for this week, over the course of the whole week, last week I did a series on jazz and improv as models or metaphors for God in the world. That's being worked into a new book manuscript. This week, the question, where in the world is God, is the framework for the week based on some writing that I did while I was on sabbatical up at St. John's University in Collegeville, Minnesota. So part of this is in a publishable form, though I hope I've worked the material in new ways and we'll be doing more interactive conversation with you. The question for me is a deeply personal spiritual question that I suppose is at the heart of my own spiritual life, which is, how do I know and discern and think about God's role not only in my life but in the world? And the resources that I'll bring to bear over the next 5 days come from several sources. The first and primary one is out of Luther. So we'll be doing some work with Martin Luther this week. The second source that I draw on heavily is religion and science. I've been teaching courses and thinking about issues in religion and science for the last 7-8 years now. And so, for instance, tomorrow we'll think about where in the world is God in the middle of a project I know about robotics and artificial intelligence. That may sound a little odd, but that's tomorrow's session. So religion and science, Luther, feminist thought, all kind of weave together to help us reflect on what I think is an interesting question about how do we discern, think about, question where God's action in the world is. And the hope for this next week is that we will try to think about these questions together. Probably my hope is that I'll raise as many questions for you as we will provide not so much answers, but at least strategies to think about things. I'd originally thought about retitling this session maybe Music for the End of Time, a theology for living into the future. The with the millennium coming and all the conversation up here over the last week or two about the Tree of Life and Revelations and apocalyptic material fitting with the summer theme, one could think about music facing the end of time. I think it's Quartet for the End of Time that Oliver Mézian wrote, and I think about that kind of music in the background. So each of these sessions has a musical form. Today's will be called Dissonance, and in a moment I ask Paul Rohde, I now owe him an ice cream, to play two hymns for me on the piano. And that's all you'll need to hear as we'll begin to talk about the theme of what dissonance sounds like. And each of the musical forms this week is more of a teaser than it has anything to do with music as such. So they're really forms that I want you to think about. Before we get into the actual content of the session, I want to talk just a little bit about what I call theological method. That is how you go about thinking through large questions about faith. The purpose, like I said, for all these sessions, I think, is to ask careful and critical questions, in some cases deeply problematic questions, for me anyway, about how Christian faith positions itself in what some academics and some folks are calling a postmodern world. That is a world that's riddled with ambiguity, with tension, with pluralism, with conflict. We live in a world that's not simple. And we want to see what the problems and possibilities are as Christianity tries to position itself in that world. So my hope this week, and we'll do a fairly lengthy discussion tomorrow on what the Enlightenment means and how that affects theology. I don't want to scare you off from this because it's not a deep philosophical discussion. But I think questions about how we gauge who we are in our culture. So the questions that we might think about is, what is the nature and purpose of our relationship between God and the world in a world that I just talked about is highly pluralistic, highly conflictive, and a world that's also marked as one that's scientific and technological? What is theology? One of the resources that I used for my doctoral dissertation that I still read frequently, his name is Alfred North Whitehead. Some of you may know who he is. He was a contemporary of Einstein's. He wrote, his first major writing was the Principia Mathematica with Bertrand Russell. And he was highly influenced by science and technology. Lived in Britain and became one of the century's greatest philosophers, eventually moved to the States. And in a book that he used later called Adventures of Ideas, he has the following little sentence. It is more important that a proposition be interesting than that it be true. Okay, it's more interesting that a proposition be interesting than that it be true. And I would substitute the word theology. It's more interesting that theology be interesting than that it be true. What was Whitehead meaning by that? I think very often we end up in dead-end conversations about what's true and what isn't. And that often translates into what's right and what's wrong, as if there's a truth out there that we're all going to get to somehow and agree on it. And we end up in very conflictive, sometimes, either-or discussions. What Whitehead means about something being interesting is that it sparks conversation, it's fruitful. It pushes one so that truth becomes more of a process than an end goal to be reached. And for me, that's the whole function of theology, is that theology is not so much something that the Christian community does in order to find the truth, but it's a dialogical process along the way in which many voices contribute. In other words, it's more like a conversation. So truth is something which provokes faithfulness, which provokes fruitfulness. It's interesting. So just so that you know that, that's my kind of beginning point for theological method. Okay, so the goal for today's session is to understand how Christian faith positions itself on the boundaries of life's opposites. That is, of heaven on earth and hell on earth. And I'll explain what I mean by that in just a minute. First of all, I'd like to ask Paul Rohde to simply play two little hymns that I have marked in here, very close together. Play number 212 and number 216. Just one verse of 212. Okay. Paul was Gary's accompanist for his senior college tuba recital.
My greatest claim.
Just a few pages away.
Which one is there?
216. About those two hymns for a minute. The first one is, anybody know? I heard some of you know that one. Let us bring them together. Okay? Beautiful harmonies, aren't there? And it's familiar. What contrast, this may be so obvious, it's extraordinarily painful to even raise, but what are the two differences in that you heard in the hymns? The first one?
Harmony.
Familiar?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Singability.
Singable, isn't it?
Yeah.
Okay, and it's probably used in your congregations, right?
Familiar.
Yeah, it's very familiar. What about the second one?
Discord.
Unfamiliar.
Discord.
Dissonant. Discord.
Unsingable.
Unsingable, yep. Okay. Anybody use that in their congregations?
Never heard.
What's the text?
It's for love so freely spent. For perfect love so freely spent, for fellowship restored, we celebrate your sacrament and sing your praise, O Lord.
Now that seems worthy. There's dissonance between the lyrics and the music.
Yeah, right. Yeah, it's a strange.
Who wrote the tune?
Vincent Persichetti. Anybody know Persichetti's music?
Is he alive?
Well, yeah. I played band music of his, which sounds a lot like him. But it's this wonderful. I really like this hymn. We were in a congregation occasionally that would use it. Paul Munns has played that in different settings.
Persichetti did not find a conflict between the words and his music.
Sorry.
Yeah.
Sorry. But it is a different sound, isn't it? Things rub up against each other that don't sound right in it. You know, you try singing this with your average congregation, and most people just sit and sort of listen to it and think, ugh, you know? Now the question that we might sing, or that we might ask is, most of our music on Sunday sounds sort of like the first one. Singable. Most of us want it that way, right? You wouldn't last too long if every hymn was Persichetti. The question that I want to raise is whether or not, and I'm using this very metaphorically, maybe, do we need more Persichetti in our Sunday morning services? Okay. It's very dissonant, it's discordant, it's strident. A little story that helps pick up on the notion of discord or dissonance. Susan and I both went to Concordia College. Some of you may know that school. And I was a piano major for the first 2 years while I was there. And you were required to go to what seemed like an endless supply of concerts. And they'd stamp your little book. And one in particular I remember was an organ concert that was for wedding music. And all the organ students played different pieces that you could hear and possibly use in your wedding. Well, partway through, and I wrote about this in the book, we're sitting there and all of a sudden this noise from hell breaks out in the sanctuary, and that whole group turns around and looks up, and it was this wild piece by Oliver Mézian, which, if you know, is a French contemporary composer whose stuff sounds a little bit like Persichetti, but much wilder and more flagrant and really discordant, and yet beautiful in its own kind of way. And eventually it sort of resolved itself at the end. And I thought, what an awful piece for a wedding. And yet, for those of you who have been in relationships for years, whether it's been in marriages or partnerships or families, know that sometimes life sounds a whole lot like Mazian and not very often like Here Comes the Bride, right? So I've got to thinking about the fact that for a lot of us, and I've had lots of experience with this, most of us have this somehow notion, this notion that Christianity should be a place where we hear the harmonious, the singable. Now, I think at Holden it's a little bit different. We talk about the problems, and I think we do in the congregation as well. But the question is, what do we do with the dissonance in life? And what is dissonance? And is it something that we should hear more? And how is God present in the dissonance? Okay, so keep that image for a minute of the audible, you heard dissonance, the very strong contrast between let's break bread together and the Persichetti piece. Okay, I want to change venues a minute and describe an art show that I saw a few years ago. A good friend of ours, Sheila Agee, who used to run the Civic Fine Arts Center in Sioux Falls, had a wonderful show at the I.D. Dalrymple Gallery at Augustana, and she titled it Standing on the Boundaries, Heaven on Earth, Hell on Earth. And it was set up in a really interesting way. She had done, the gallery was sort of lengthwise set up so that half was obviously heaven and the other half was hell. And then there was a kind of a mid point going down the middle, and she had placed a park bench at the front so that you could kind of sit on the boundary. And what was fascinating was the night of the gallery opening, watching how people moved through the gallery to look at the paintings. The heaven side were all landscapes. Beautiful prairie, she lives out on the prairie in this beautiful house, and she had done all kinds of prairie landscapes. We live in South Dakota, and she had picked up all the colors of the prairie river nearby and her dogs, of the cattle, and there wasn't a person to be found in the heaven on earth. Now that said something about Sheila, which we won't talk about, but this heaven on earth, and she'd framed them in these big gold ornate frames and white mats around them and lots of light. And then you walk to the other side of the gallery, and there was a different side of Sheila's life as a painter and as an artist, and there were pictures up all over the gallery of very discordant, I would use the word dissonant, pictures of violence in the world, particularly of women and violence, and several strong pictures about violence that the church had done to women. She gave me a picture, and I'm still not sure what to do with it. It sort of sits in my office periodically, of this sort of woman-like figure with this very violent cross that's been thrust up into the woman. And it kind of says something about what the church has done to some women. And I was so kind of, I mean, I spent a lot of time looking at that picture and thinking about it. And then I had my students also go to her art opening and spend some time there. And many of them were shocked and offended by the picture and created a lot of conversation. So Sheila gave the picture to me, and I have it in my office. But I sort of keep it down here because if I hang it up, I never know what kind of conversation I'm going to get into. So, but I do bring it to class periodically, and I have my students write on it. But the funny thing about this picture was watching people move through the heaven side, and there was this, oh, isn't that beautiful, and this is so lovely, and then they'd get into hell, and there would be just this kind of quiet, sort of strained conversation. She had done this wonderful graffiti all over the walls that the pictures were hung on. But the really interesting section was where people, and I tried this a couple times, sat in the park bench. And there you found yourself pivoting and kind of between heaven on earth and hell on earth. And of course, Sheila's whole point, and I hope it's obvious by now, is that life is really like sitting on the park bench. that every day is filled with stark contradictions, that we live in the midst of what you could call lived contradictions, or maybe a different word for that would be ambiguity, of opposites. That while you're up at Holden, we had one of those moments last week, you know, you're in one of the most beautiful places on earth, and we had been up here, I think, 3-4 days when the news about the Kennedys came. Just kind of a, there's kind of a gasp at the dinner table. You know, in the midst of community that at one sense seems like the most peaceful, wonderful place, is interrupted incredible tragic news. And I find that my life is like that most every day. I get up in the morning and my favorite routine, you probably have one, I sit I in my nightgown, kind of reach out and grab the, well, you've usually brought it in, but you get the Argus Leader, the Sioux Falls newspaper, and I make my pot of you know, Earl Grey tea, let the Airedale out, and then you read the paper and you hear the news in the morning, and it's kind of this weird, jarring experience all day long. And sometimes you don't even want to hear the news. I think it's important, that's why I think Holden provides a place of rest. There are times when it's important to get away, to let your spirit and heart quiet down from just that constant barrage of mixture of good and evil. So that's a second image that I want to provide for you of what life, I think, in our world is very much like, which is that for a lot of us, life is this boundary between heaven and hell, or good or evil, and we sometimes, most of the day, are crossing through that boundary. And very often what's terrifying about our world is that all the conflict that we experience is a result of, I think, and based in a large part on our fear. I've had a couple experiences this year of things that I didn't know what would happen. I've read Elie Wiesel my whole life. Most of you, are you familiar with Elie Wiesel's books, Night, right after? He's a Jewish author who writes about the Holocaust. And in sort of theological training, have studied particularly the Lutheran contribution to the Holocaust. And we just got back from a trip with 200 high school students to Europe. Some of you, I've talked about this already. And one of the stops that we made was to Dachau. And I really felt incredibly ambivalent about going. I didn't really want to go, because somehow seeing that, and sort of like reading Elie Wiesel, you can hardly take it, at least I can. It's some of the most painful reading. So we got off the bus with these 200 high school students, and the first thing, how many of you have been to one of the German concentration camps? So you've had this experience. We walked in and we saw a video about Dachau, and then we were just sort of let loose. It was a very hot day. It felt a little bit like it does out here today. Very hot German sun, and we walked for, we were only there a couple hours. And I think the hardest part for me was walking into the barracks, where they talked about the details of how the prisoners had to keep their individual areas so clean. And the incredible perfectionism that existed in the camps with keeping their lives just as clean as possible. And what the Nazis would do if there was a piece of straw missing on the mat, or something a half inch out of order or something, they would be hung outside in the village in the center of Dachau, up by their arms and strung up for an hour if they violated these codes of cleanliness. And I sort of knew how awful these things were, but somehow you saw it again, you read it again, it was even more meticulous, more horrible. And we were there for a couple hours. We went back to the buses, and the kids were noticeably disturbed. I mean, they were just kind of agitated. So we loaded all the 200 kids up and the 30-some chaperones onto the bus, and we went to a big German restaurant outside of Dachau and had this big German lunch. Well, this was kind of right there, you know? The kids even said something and said, God, I don't feel much like eating. I mean, you know, it was this cheerful German big restaurant, and they served us this wonderful meal, and yet we had just been at Dachau. And for the rest of the day, everybody felt kind of icky. I mean, there was just this sense of dis-ease about how life could be so, at one time, good, and at one time, so painfully awful. Dachau is but one dramatic example, I think, of what's happening in our culture, about how and who it is that makes life heaven and hell for each other, and how Christian faith deals with that. So on your sheets, I want you to look at a quote. It's the second, third paragraph down there from a theologian. Some of you may recognize his name, Paul Sponheim. In fact, this book, I think there's one lone copy sitting over in the bookshelf called Faith and the Other. And this quote is from the introduction. He says, "As I meet the other or others, I become anxiously aware that my sense of reality, my world, is no longer available to me as a secure possession. Were it not so visually obstructive, I would regularly place the words other and otherness in quotation marks to indicate precisely the loss of a comfortable worldview in which the subject-object distinction reigns supreme." That'll be tomorrow's lecture. But he's talking about this notion that somehow our world is sensing that what was once comfortable no longer feels that way. "This may seem a perilous time," he says. "In fact, we hear of certain decisive holocausts and religious wars thought to be safely interred in some dark past. This is indeed an anxious age." In seeing Dachau in light of Kosovo, Gary and I just picked up the magazine that day, Stern, which is the German news magazine, and on the cover was a comparison of the Holocaust to Kosovo. What Sponheim is saying is that for many people, particularly privileged people who live in fairly comfortable setting, I mean, that's how I've grown up, relatively comfortable life, but the notion that somehow that seems to be slipping away, and that what is happening is indeed a perilous world. It's a world that's marked by anxiety, and part of that anxiety comes in the crossing of the boundary or the meeting of that which is fearful or other. In other words, the metaphor that we could use that we picked up earlier is this notion of dissonance. It's "let us break bread together" feels like the comfortable, familiar, safe hymn, when in fact what we may feel like, and in fact what the world sounds more like, is this experience of dissonance. And that doesn't yet need to be equated with evil. I want to be very careful about that. Okay. One more metaphor, and then we'll stop with the metaphors. And I've listed it on your sheet. That's the Sioux Falls Airport and landing at O'Hare. Sioux Falls has a wonderful little airport. I think there are 6 gates or something. And I've flown more in my life in the last few years than I've ever flown. And I always like coming back to the Sioux Falls Airport. It's really easy to find your way because you only go one way, and you get off the plane, and more often than not, the flights connect through Minneapolis if you take Northwest, and I can't tell you how many times I've gotten to the gate where I'm going to connect through to Minneapolis, and sure enough, there's somebody else from Sioux Falls that I know that's coming back on the flight. So very often you ended up in conversations with people who know somebody else, and it's this wonderful little airport. You get off, everybody seems to kind of know where they're going. "Oh yeah, I live up at Del Rapids," or I work for so-and-so, and "oh, you know so-and-so," and it's this wonderful sort of shared little community, and the airport's very safe and comfortable. Very different than when I go to O'Hare, which, if you've been to Chicago, O'Hare is a very crazy, mixed-up place, right? You land, and the first thing, and this last time I landed at the United, no, I landed at the Northwest Terminal, Terminal 2, but the plane was taking off in Terminal 1 at the United Terminal. So, for one thing, you have to walk 3/4 of a mile, at least it feels like, through
underground,
if you've been through with those flashing lights. Every language in the world, you know, in just one quick move, you're hearing all different kinds of languages, all different kinds of people, and it's a completely different experience. Sioux Falls, landing at O'Hare. This is lots of commentary I'm getting somewhere. I got a letter today from a colleague of mine who teaches at Augustana, Michelle Bartel, in the ethics department. And she just, I completely forgot to bring this little letter to the editor that she sent me. The Oglala Sioux tribe, which is, I think West River? Is it West? It's right. West River was hit by a tornado this spring and a lot of damage done. And there's been a lot of press, particularly in the Argus Leader, about trying to get lots of help and just the poverty already in this community and then the wiping out families and homes. And there was this little editorial that she sent me that I think is her worst fear, is that Sioux Falls really is sort of like landing in the Sioux Falls airport. This man wrote an editorial saying, well, doggone it, why do we have to have all this press about this tribe that's already gotten everything free anyway? I mean, really what we ought to do is just ignore them because they're just getting a free ride from the government. And we're sick and tired of giving all these privileges to all these people. And it was just kind of going on and on about those folks out there. And after all, there was a big tornado in Spencer, and they didn't get any free. I mean, it was just a sort of craziness. And the letters to the editor in Sioux Falls follow one after the other. Sioux Falls is predominantly, I mean, like 99-point-something% white community, but with a growing minority of immigrants. And the letters come in constantly in the Argus Leader, particularly blasting Lutheran Social Services for taking in immigrants. And my students last year, as part of our service project, we worked with the Sudanese community and kind of got a first-hand sense of what it's like being an immigrant and some of the issues these folks deal with, but really hateful, angry letters that come in, very often expressing fear about this encounter of dissonance or what appears to be like, for some people, leaving the confines of Sioux Falls and heading to the O'Hare Airport. I get the same message very often from the undergraduates that I teach, that what Christianity is about is finding a center. And that center is Jesus, and the center is everybody's center. And that finding the center of one's faith makes one comfortable, harmonious, safe, right? The whole point of being a Christian is so that you can be comfortable, knowing that everything's sort of kind of got it together, and I'm characterizing that a bit. But that kind of picture seems to be in conflict with life on the boundary. Okay? So the questions that we want to raise together today are coming out of a whole variety of images, and I apologize for just throwing all kinds of images at you. But I think what I want to raise about this is, where is God and how does Christian faith address the world that's marked by these different metaphors? A world that seems to me much more like persicetti than let us break bread together. A world that in its reality is much more like O'Hare. Okay? Even though those of us who come from Sioux Falls, O'Hare breaks into our world and O'Hare is in our world. There's lots of difference and diversity and pain and otherness right in the communities that may, for many of us, even feel safe and comfortable. So down on that page, I have a couple questions, and I want you to help think through these for a minute. Describe an experience that you've had with a voice of the other. In other words, I want you to think for a minute of an experience that you've had of being on the edge, being on the boundary, either being the other or encountering an other. That is, some engagement of something where you felt on the boundary, on the edge. Okay? Can you call to mind some sort of experience that's had a sense of radical otherness for you? Anybody want to think about what one might be? Yes.
This is a long story and I'm going to make it very short.
Okay.
I became suddenly and mysteriously ill 6 years ago. I managed to continue teaching for a year, but I began to notice that my cognitive skills were slipping. and I was always fatigued. Mm-hmm. And because I was fatigued and I had insomnia, I became anxious. I had to quit teaching after a year, and I began a descent into hell on earth. Mm-hmm. I lost more than 40 pounds, about 50 pounds. I lost my hair. My skin radically changed. I wrote what I called outbursts, not poems, about being inhuman, a beast. I wrote one called "The Bald and Bearded." A bald and bearded lady speaks, because facial hair was growing, but the hair on my head was falling out. And I went to doctors right away. I went to doctors all the time. I went to Mayo Clinic.
The words of my eyes.
Right.
I was inaccurately diagnosed twice, and then more or less accurately diagnosed. The result of this was a loss of, well, the central problem seems to have been that I could not absorb nutrients, and it put me in touch with the other. That is, the other we see in the face of hunger.
Mm-hmm.
Because not being able, I had food, but I wasn't absorbing the nutrients, and I began to live the life of the malnourished person. And let me tell you, it's a horrible life. Because whether or not you're educated, when you can't think, when you can't figure things out, you're truly at a loss.
Mm-hmm.
And then to have pain on top of it, and increasing pain, and I would imagine this is true of malnourished people, mm-hmm. because the GI tract, put it bluntly, gets completely screwed up. Well, as I said, it's a long story, and I don't want to bore you with the details, but where in the world is God? That's exactly what drew me to this session, because I always, you know, I wasn't screaming, "God, where are you?"
Mm-hmm.
But I've never known such a dark night of the soul, and it was so long. It went on for years. I was filled with shame because, after all, I had a PhD, you know, and I had students wanting letters of recommendation I could not write. So that's my experience of otherness. I would say to Jerry, "I'm not myself."
Mm-hmm.
And he'd say, "Oh, yes, you are." And he'd write me these notes, you know, but actually, I think I wanted him to say, "You are not yourself." I wanted him to say, "This is not the person I have known," you know, because mm-hmm. I couldn't do those things that I had always done. So it was both, I was both in the position of that other person,
mm-hmm.
and I knew, of course, that I had been, if you're going to talk about self and other,
right.
that I had been self. Now I was other. And I was desperate to get back to self. I was always on that boundary.
So in a way, there was an interchange, but also one fist with your identification of an experience of radical otherness, that in a strange way you gained empathy with that you didn't want to, in terms
well,
of the malnourished.
Yes, I mean, well, there are a number of us in this room, I'm right. certain, who have always reached out to with yeah. compassion.
Oh, absolutely.
The other. But then when you are the other, mm-hmm. it becomes quite a... And I don't claim that this is precisely the experience that malnourished person has, but I think I have a window into it that I didn't have before. And then just the shame of being perfectly unattractive
yeah.
and, my skin was yellow. I mean, I felt like a monster, a freak of nature. There's just, and then the guilt. What did I do to bring this on, you know? Because that's pretty much part of my upbringing. But,
yeah.
It must have been my fault. I overworked.
We do that a lot with illness anyway in our culture. There's a dangerous line, I think, between blaming people when they get sick. But what an incredible, and it sounds like it came on suddenly.
Very suddenly.
I mean, that would just have to be an incredibly horrifying kind of experience in which everything, you know, your language is much more eloquent than Sponheim's, but this everything that was comfortable and that was you was gone.
and life was filled with paradox. I was all constantly thirsty. I had the driest mouth you can imagine. And drinking liquids made the sensation worse. And now I have a permanent dry mouth with burning, and burning all over my skin. That's the result of this. But when it first came, it was just horrifying. I mean, to think that I could or would have to continue to live in that kind of medieval torture chamber, if you will. You know, it was such a monstrous notion. I just couldn't, you know, and you're told to embrace your pain, that's the way I deal with it. So it's pretty, I mean, everything that you've said hits the nail on the head for me, except the questions of faith and doubt. And I've always believed that doubt is an essential element in faith of any kind. And I have never been one to blame God for these kinds of circumstances, so.
I think your example, I want to just take that as an example, and maybe all of you can fit somewhere your experience of otherness into some place where you've had a sense of loss of comfort, sense that yourself becomes, you know, I had this puny little experiences here of not, I don't speak a word of German, all I can do is read a little bit of theological German. And I went to Germany this year for the first time and spent about 48 hours by myself before I joined up with a group, and I had this weird sense, and it's just a little silly sense of being another. But I went into this restaurant, or a little takeaway place to get a pastry, and I managed to ask enough that I could get the pastry. But then the clerk started yelling, saying something, and I kept saying, you know, nicht verstehen, I don't understand, I don't speak German. And she kept getting louder and louder at me, and the people were starting to watch and gather around me. And finally this young woman said, she wants to know if you want a sack. You know, and that's such a little stupid example, but I felt so self-conscious. Because all these people were standing around, and I could just hear, you know, this stupid American can't speak any, you know, and have this real sense of feeling in one little minute, relatively completely painless, say, but a sense of just feeling so voiceless, like, you know, there was total lack of communication, okay? And your story, I think, dramatizes in a wonderful way this larger sense of people's anxiety and fear and shame and guilt, and then this raises all these theological questions.
Yeah. Another important element of that, when we think about these kinds of experiences with otherness, because we also, of course, can think of some other kinds where the enrichment is obvious, but
exactly.
This kind is loss of control. That feeling like, I'm not in control of this situation, I can't fix it, whether that's about me or someone else, because I've had some where it's really about someone else. When I used to work in a battered women's shelter, you know, I wasn't at risk, but I couldn't fix anything, you know. Or when it's me, to feel like I'm at risk, something bad is going to happen and I can't control it. And that's, I think, you know, the terror of misdiagnosis.
Yeah.
I can't fix it.
You can't fix it, you can't, that moment at its worst where everything's just up for grabs, you have no control over it, you can't do anything about it, and worse, others can't seem to do anything for it either.
Right.
I mean, it's just that lack of, some loss of control. And we haven't even begun to talk, you're right, there's a whole other way of talking about experience of otherness, of enrichment, and if we had another 2-hour session, we'd move that way. But I wanted to just see where the group sort of had a feeling for otherness. So those questions I want you to keep thinking about a little bit. And I want to raise your situation and connect it to me for one of the most difficult questions I think the Christian faith has to deal with, which is, what does the Christian faith have to say to these radical experiences of otherness? Deanne's session last week on hospitality made me think a lot about, it's fine to talk about inviting a stranger into your house. You might even invite somebody you don't even like really well. But what do you do with those people whose otherness is so radically disturbing to you? Where do you find God in them? And of course, you can already see what's happening in the language. Relates a little bit to Matins this morning, when we talk about people with labels who are other instead of the person with this. But how? What resources? Because I think part of the difficulty of this question is that sometimes the Christian faith has not been helpful for experiences of radical otherness. Maybe by giving simplistic answers. Well, we know where God is. God, you should just bear up and celebrate your pain or something. I mean, I'm just making
embrace it.
Embrace your pain. Oh, great, you know. I had surgery for the first time. I didn't enjoy embracing my pain at all. I liked the Tylenol with codeine, you know. It looked a whole lot better than embracing it. Or Christianity, in part, look at what we've done with the voices of the other that we haven't liked too well. Right? We've crucified them, we've exterminated them, we've burned them at the stake, and it just keeps going on and on. We have a 2,000-year legacy of very painful history of what we've done with the voice of the other. And I think that's what Sponheim's hinting at. Well, it may seem like those wars and those Holocausts were back there somewhere, but they can happen daily, and they can happen in our own daily experience. It doesn't have to be Dachau to experience this radical sense of abandonment and fear and pain of otherness.
No. I don't mean to suggest this as an answer, but I think the most radical part of this experience has taught me that I am the other. Now there's no distance.
Yeah.
Self and other is the same. Because I'm a human being, and so what is possible to happen to any human being can happen to me.
Mm-hmm.
And it's almost the same as that line that I love in one of Margaret Lawrence's novels. By middle age, everything that you thought happened to other people's families happens to you.
Right, right. That's a good comment. You just did exactly, and I couldn't have asked for a better comment for where I was thinking about what one might say. The Gospel of John is famous for the I am statement. I am the way, I am the truth. And you've just added one. I am the other. And I think you said, I'm the other in which I experience, well, you said it better. But this notion that you became the other, that self and other are joined together.
And fear is comprised of trying to prevent the other from entering my life.
Right. Okay, so if we take, and isn't that sometimes what we've done is when we're afraid and fearful, we don't want the other to enter in. Okay? Now, and I think that's not only Christianity, it's human nature. I mean, Christian history is part of a whole human history that does this. So my examples earlier, it's not just like Christians do awful things, but it's part of who we are. Dan?
You know, echoing on some of these things too, and I think part of what is both the promise but also the peril of Christianity is it does add that theological dimension.
Mm-hmm.
I was thinking for many of us who are gay or lesbian, this sort of this sense that we're always going to be part of the otherness, we're never going to be part of the real thing.
Mm-hmm.
And the teaching that goes along that we're part of the fall, others are part of the goodness of creation. Or I think 2 weeks ago when we had Deaf and Hard of Hearing, Hearing Awareness Week, and one of our deaf preachers talked about how for centuries the deaf were excluded based on the Paul's verse that unless you hear the gospel, you can't enter the kingdom of God. And so this notion they can't hear the gospel, therefore, but the sense of somehow being created the other that can never be redeemed. For some of it is just such an enormously painful lifelong struggle in that.
It is a lifelong struggle, and it doesn't help. Our language is so difficult because we're constantly
Even the danger of using the word other is that it already sets up categories of us and them and all those kinds of things. And I think the resource that I think one can possibly bring to Christian theology, that Christian theology does bring to this dilemma, is that somehow in the incarnation of God in Christ, one rids the promise is that otherness isn't what defines us, in that sense of otherness becoming prohibitive to being part of God's grace.
So, and when you say that, are you assuming that the fundamental distinction of something and something else, so self and other, mm-hmm. is that we mark that as this is of God and this isn't? And that we've made some kind of fundamental, structural maybe, mm-hmm. assumption that when I'm self, when I'm good, we're lumping a bunch of categories together, that this is somehow associated with what is sacred and what's divine, and what I don't like, I demonize mm-hmm. and make not God, so that kenosis and entering in incarnation then wipes out that distinction.
Right.
Is that
right.
where you're going?
Or at least creates new boundaries.
Yeah.
Once, and in fact, this whole notion of standing on the boundary for me is precisely where I think God does enter. Luther's language is that God is hidden under God's opposites, so that in weakness we find power. Now, I realize there's danger in that language, but I also think there's possibility, so that what happens mm-hmm. is that your rich explanation of talking about I am the other, now you've somehow gained a new sense of who the other is by becoming other, and I hear in your language some healing and some wholeness.
And there's also the... it's been a very long struggle, mm-hmm. but fear is not really a part of my life anymore.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Now, see, that's really helpful, clear language, very descriptive language. That's part of the reason I wanted to do this with stories. Because as you listen to people's narratives, you can begin to hear what happens in the transitions that happen.
And I say that, I have to add that I was never afraid of death. Mm-hmm. In fact, I welcomed death. That's how bad it was. I wanted to die. I'm not talking about fear of death.
Right. No,
I'm talking about fear of what else I would have to go through. And I'd like to add to what Dan has said, that the process of teaching women's studies or of doing feminist work has meant for me a recognition in terms of race, class, and gender, and adding to gender sexual mm-hmm. identity, whatever you want to mm-hmm. say, just how privileged I've been without being aware, mm-hmm. entirely aware of all that privilege. You know, like I routinely pass out a sheet on heterosexual privilege, quite heterosexual privilege, in my classes, because I think that we just take for granted a lot of this, and it somehow, it gets very messy, but it gets grouped with what it means to be a Christian. You know, like, I've almost deserved this privilege.
Sure. Something you've earned, Paul?
Well, I'm a little mystified as exactly what to do with the opposites, because I think another resource of Christian faith mm-hmm. is the way it lets the opposite stand.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, it was taken with your description of Dachau
mm-hmm.
and how it was trying to make that horrendous camp
mm-hmm.
heavenly, or at least
right.
orderly.
Exactly. Right.
And, you know, so many times it will happen, I think of the movie Ordinary People,
mm-hmm.
you know, where the Mary Tyler Moore did such mm-hmm. a marvelous job of playing that part. And the power of this order, and it was only going to be the heaven side of the art gallery.
Yeah.
And then the cataclysm just erupts
okay, sure.
from within that. So that there's also a sense in which, I mean, there's the freedom to say, I am not the other.
Mm-hmm.
And I cannot ever know another's experience, and I am certainly not God.
Right.
Which is where the theology of the cross.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's it's helpful to start talking about otherness in general, and then quickly we need to talk about the difference between, is there really radical evil?
Right.
And is that kind of otherness is different than sexual difference, maybe,
right.
or racial difference, and it's precisely
right.
our inability or unwillingness mm-hmm. to make that distinction that leads us then to say, well,
right.
there is evil in the world, and you're it, and so I'm going to get rid of you.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm, you know, I don't want to do that, but I also don't want to say every tree is the tree of life.
Right.
Right?
Exactly. And that's, you're probably, my hope is that we're creating more things to think about. I don't think this is an easy discussion. I mean, part of the whole reason I wanted to raise these questions today is to provoke us to think about these kinds of questions. Because I think the very language of otherness or opposites or boundaries is problematic and hopeful. Yeah, Paul?
I was just gonna say, I think my most significant experience of the boundary,
mm-hmm.
I'm a parish pastor, is the times I'm called into horribly tragic situations and how often something genuinely funny happens mm. in the midst of it. It is uncanny. And I do not offer that comment to minimize the pain or the horror or the tragedy in any way, but to say that even the ones experiencing it the most directly
mm-hmm.
are kind of freed in the middle of that, and you're back across the boundary.
Yeah.
The blues.
Yeah, the blues.
There you
the
go.
And session right. last week when yeah. you talked about the pattern of the blues, mm-hmm. that you have this sort of statement of, bold statement of tragedy, and then if I learn my lesson, the last line is usually a kind of twist
right.
that you have to let go for it to be funny.
Right.
Because yeah. if you're still clinging to the to that, it won't be funny, it won't make sense.
Mm-hmm.
And it doesn't fix things, but somehow, and again, now I'm really out of my field to talk about this, but that somehow there's something in the dissonance that breaks through that
right.
kind of what the Celts talk about, a thin place
mm-hmm.
you know, that you see through.
That's a wonderful example. I had this little experience of surgery last year, never having been in the hospital since I was 5. And I went in for one of those, you'll be out in an hour and to work on Monday sort of talks. But this, of course, could happen. So the of course it could happen happened, and 6 hours later, my mom and Gary are still sitting waiting for things to. And I came out and spent 6 days in the hospital, and I remember one of these moments, I mean, I felt quite like I had never felt in my life. A lot of pain, a lot of frustration. But the morphine seemed to add a certain level of chaos to it. And I remember Dr. Smith, this bald-headed surgeon who had the, you know, the typical sort of bedside manner you'd expect. Good surgeon, but no bedside manners. And he comes in, and I'm still slightly out of it, and he says, "Hello, I'm Dr. Smith." And I said, "Hello, I'm Dr. Peterson." I thought, I'm not letting you get away with this, you know.
How fit are you?
You know, it was one of those brief moments. And then I must have had it in for him, because then later, a friend of mine brought, the same woman who wrote the letter to me, brought for a gift during the hospital stay. Have you seen those boxing nun puppets?
Yeah.
You know, where the nun, well, later in the week he came in and I brought out my boxing nun puppet. So anyway, it's those kind of feelings though of all of a sudden something shifts, you know?
And it makes me think that there's a difference between being out of control and saying I'm not captive.
Right.
You know, I'm still out of control, but I'm not stuck.
Mm-hmm. Good distinction. Thank you.
Fair enough. I was kind of curious in the discussion, particularly in relationship to the other and dissonant voices, about the guy who wrote the editorial.
Mm.
It, you know, if you listen to our reaction here, you know, it was one of, oh, that guy, you know, laughter, mm-hmm. you know, that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. So I guess my question is, how does one embrace the other within community?
Right.
How do I live within a congregation with the other voice.
Right.
You know, do I say you can't be a part of this community? Mm-hmm. It seems to me, at least that's one of the things for me, that the Christian faith is, I mean, that I find in the Christian faith, that it's embracing of the other. Mm-hmm. And that as it embraces, then I have a sense of connectedness to that, even though I may not like it.
Right.
You know, I mean, I don't share those views, mm-hmm. but how do I live with the person that does share those right. views?
Because in some situation, I'm going to be the one who has the views that everybody else finds horrifying. And I think your question is the one, you know, I need to end here, but I think it's the one that is probably the most important. How do we live in community as Christians with those voices that we so easily dismiss, especially if it's on the opposite side, that's easy to say, well, that poor unenlightened soul sure doesn't get it. But that poor unenlightened soul might be the one that I sit next to when I take communion on Sunday. And those resources, we could just, that'll be pulled together more through the week. But that's a metaphor. You mentioned community, body of Christ. Those are beginning places where we can talk about, well, where in the world is God? It's in the person who wrote the editorial. It's in the relationship I develop as I sit next to that person, that I have to learn to listen to that person. You know, the very things that I don't like about myself are the things that keep coming up, you know? And you find that inside yourself.
I simply think that there's something in that other person that we could learn from. Mm-hmm. And I don't mean to give that person the time of day to go on ranting and raving, but, you know, I've been a liberal most of my adult life. I mean, let's not define liberal just now, but at any rate, I can find that position as confining mm-hmm. as what we've labeled a conservative position. Mm-hmm. And so, yes, maybe I could find in that statement something with which I could partially agree mm-hmm. or care to examine.
Or examine or empathize with a person's fear.
Right.
I mean, that's what you were talking about earlier, is it in that position, and I think, you know, the ultimate big theological category for me is God in Christ somehow embraces the contradictions, allows us to live with contradiction, and we'll try to flesh out what that means more during the week. You've been one.
I was thinking one of the experiences of other, having become adoptive parent, mm-hmm. and all the language to which I'm referred to, mm-hmm. And the concept that I couldn't possibly love my children if they were not born to me, mm-hmm. and yet our relationship with God, we are not born to God.
Mm-hmm. We become adopted in a sense, mm-hmm. rebirthed. Mm-hmm. That's a nice image.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So right there in the tradition is a whole kind of metaphor of how we deal with our own otherness that gets birthed into baptism. I mean, that's a wonderful example. Mm-hmm. You've come with experience that I think illustrates that. I need to bring the session to a close, but over the next four sessions, this is the kind of thing that we'll be doing together, exploring the bigger questions of faith, looking at it through different narratives. Tomorrow we'll be looking at questions related to some of the same issue, but new boundaries. What does it mean to talk about flesh, humanness? We're going to look at what it means to be human, particularly in light of some research I have a friend doing on embodied artificial intelligence. So I'm hoping that'll pique. If you want to come and think about what's happening culturally and technologically that's drastically shifting who we are as human beings, it may raise some interesting questions about who we are. Okay, thank you.
Thank you.